Washington, D.C., January 1854. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, a bill extending the possibility of slavery into the vast western territory covered by the Louisiana Purchase, has just been introduced into the United States Senate. The legislation is a direct contradiction to a previous compromise reached by pro- and anti-slavery elements of the American government, which agreed in 1820 not to extend slavery north of the 3630 line within the Louisiana Territory. The outrage against this bill in the North was immediate and ferocious. The same month it was introduced, the Senator Salmon P. Chase of Ohio and other anti-slavery politicians wrote a manifesto called The Appeal of the Independent Democrat. The open letter, which was published and read throughout the North, charged that Southern slaveholders had broken yet another promise made with the free states, and that slavery had no right to extend itself into free territory. Chase and his co-writers argued that the expansion of slavery had to be resisted at all costs, or the country itself would be consumed by it. It was an effective piece of propaganda. Although the Kansas-Nebraska Act passed, the opposition to the bill formed the nucleus of what would become the Republican Party, the first major anti-slavery party in the country's history. But the appeal of the Independent Democrat also pushed a conspiracy theory, one that Salmon Chase and others worked hard to popularize in the North. The letter claimed that the Kansas-Nebraska Act was not just a political betrayal, but that it was all part of a criminal plot, one led by the nation's wealthiest slaveholders to dominate the federal government and make the protection and extension of human slavery the fundamental goal of the United States. This conspiracy theory was known as the slave power, and as you'll hear, it was more than just a theory. This is a conspiracy you can believe in. This month's episode is another look at the turbulent politics of the 1850s United States. In some ways, it's a companion to the one I released last August about the fraudulent slave state Lecompton Constitution of Kansas. So if you want more background information about the politics of the 1850s, I'd recommend going back and listening to that one first if you haven't already. The idea of the slave power, a vast conspiracy of slaveholders to dominate the federal government of the U.S. and politically isolate the free states, was a massively popular piece of rhetoric in the northern U.S. by the late 1850s. It was an idea that started with abolitionists who were on the fringe of political life in the 1830s, who warned free state voters that southern slaveholders were not content with keeping slavery at the state level in the South. By the close of the 1850s, the annexation of Texas, the Mexican-American War, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and the Dred Scott Supreme Court decision all seem to prove this theory to be true in some way. And an increasing number of northern voters bought into the idea of a slave power that aimed to control every branch of the federal government. Some aspects of this conspiracy theory changed over time, and some accusations leveled against the slave power are exaggerated or false. But I think that the core belief behind it is undoubtedly correct. Slaveholders, who were a small minority of the U.S. population as a whole, always had an outsized influence in the federal government, in the congressional, executive, and judicial branches. They dominated the political life of the slave states, and by the 1830s, their shared material interests in slavery increasingly led pro-slavery politicians to act as a bloc, expanding the prospects for slavery in the West through Mexican conquest or through breaking previous compromises made with the free states. Slave owners did in fact consciously try to direct the foreign policy of the United States, and at times they infringed on the civil liberties of anti-slavery Northerners who tried to resist slavery at the federal level or even within their own states. Believers in the slave power conspiracy would also accuse slaveholders of wanting to expand slavery north into the free states, and even attempt to subjugate northern whites under an aristocracy of slaveholders. Historians, and even most slave owners at the time, agree that there was no intention of ever doing this. But as we'll hear later, these fears were based on things that prominent pro-slavery advocates were actually saying at the time. They were not conjured out of thin air. To grasp why the slave power conspiracy was so popular, we'll need to understand the political climate of the mid-19th century. The U.S. was undergoing a massive shift in its political system. The old Whig and Democratic parties did not have fully coherent national platforms on the issue of slavery, which was the chief political cause of the day. Pro- and anti-slavery wings existed in both major parties, with the Democrats tending to be more pro-slavery due to their strong base in the South. This led to a realignment in national politics. And this realignment occurred immediately after a major war with Mexico, a sharp increase of new immigration from Europe, and heated debate in Congress over what to do with newly acquired territory. All of this meant instability, which likely fomented a great deal of conspiratorial thinking throughout the country. The idea of a slave power was a driving force behind the creation of a new party built around opposition to slavery. But it was not the only conspiracy theory at the time, and not the only national issue that gave rise to a new party. The Know-Nothings, or the American Party, were a failed third party that formed not around slavery, but opposition to foreigners, specifically Catholics. Immigration from Ireland and Germany skyrocketed in the middle of the 19th century due to famines and political upheaval in Europe. Nearly all of the Irish immigrants and a significant minority of the Germans who arrived were Roman Catholic. The population and the civic institutions of the United States up to this point were all overwhelmingly Protestant. Voters in both the North and the South began to organize around the tenets of nativism, the belief that Catholic immigrants posed a threat to the democratic ideals of the United States, and they had to be isolated and restricted before they subjected America to rule from the Pope and Rome. Religious bigotry fueled conspiracy theories about Catholic voters stealing elections, and novels that were based on hoaxes about sexual deviancy in convents were bestsellers in America. Everywhere among nativists were fears of Catholics in America secretly colluding to overthrow democracy. But the American Party had no official position on slavery, the chief political issue of the day, so it soon evaporated along regional lines, much like the Whig Party. But the effects of the anti-immigrant paranoia were serious. In Louisville, Kentucky, in 1855, a mob led by the local Know-Nothing Party attacked Irish and German neighborhoods, and they almost destroyed the local German Catholic parish, all because of a false rumor spread by Kentucky newspapers that the Irish and German communities were stockpiling weapons and planning an attack on the day of a local election. Over 20 people were killed. The slave power conspiracy, however, had a much more lasting effect on Northern voters, probably because much of it was actually true. Let's imagine that you're a white voter in the North, let's say Ohio, in 1857, who has recently been drawn into the ranks of the newly formed Republican Party. You're a small farmer. You live far from a region where you would have had much contact with slavery. Perhaps you previously belonged to the Whigs or the Democrats. And though you are personally opposed to slavery, you mostly were drawn to the polling place based on the different parties' beliefs on banks or extending lines of credit to farmers. But by now, you are committed to the cause of stopping the extension of slavery into the territories and driving out the corruption of the slave power from the federal government. What are some of the events that happened in the past few years that brought you to this conclusion? Well, in 1845, you saw James K. Polk, a slave owner, annex Texas as a slave state. Then, in 1846, his administration pushed for a war on Mexico to capture even more territory. This war was prosecuted on the dubious claim that the United States owned all the disputed land up to the Rio Grande, and that Mexican troops attacked U.S. soldiers on American soil. Many anti-slavery politicians spoke out against war with Mexico, and they warned that adding new territory to the West would open up the possibility for the expansion of slavery. The escaped slave and the best-selling author Frederick Douglass argued for peace in the pages of his newspaper, The North Star. A freshman Whig representative from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln issued 8 different resolutions in Congress demanding that President Polk prove exactly where the Mexican troops attacked. But unless you were active in anti-slavery politics at the time, you probably didn't notice. It seemed like the nation was in lockstep in the march to war. You likely noticed what happened afterwards. The Compromise of 1850 settled what to do with all the territory captured in the Mexican War. And like many of the abolitionists and the anti-slavery politicians warned, it resulted in huge concessions to slaveholders. California was admitted as a free state, but new portions of U.S. territory now remain open to the possibility of slavery, and a new Fugitive Slave Act now requires your local law enforcement and judges to aid in the capture of escaped slaves. You yourself could be forced to enlist in a posse to capture them, and you could face jail time if you refuse. You start to wonder if the abolitionists might have been right about the slave power. By 1854, with the introduction of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, you and many of your neighbors are beginning to not only voice opposition to the slave power, but to organize against it. This bill would effectively break the Missouri Compromise, the internal peace treaty reached with the slave owners over 30 years ago to prevent the expansion of slavery in the northern regions of the vast Louisiana Territory. Now, the Democrats in the Senate are attempting to open these regions to slavery based on the decision of a local popular vote. To you, slavery has always been a regional institution imposed by the South, and freedom is the natural default state of humankind and the federal government. Many of your neighbors agree, and you form an anti-Nebraska bill club to act on these beliefs. In 1857, the slave power struck yet another blow to freedom with the Dred Scott Supreme Court decision. Dred Scott, a slave from Missouri, sued his master on the grounds that he relocated him to Wisconsin, a free territory. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where Chief Justice Roger Taney, a one-time slaveholder, ruled that Americans of African descent could not be considered citizens, and that Congress could not regulate the movement of slave property in the territories, even the northern ones that all agreed were free. By now, you and your neighbors in Ohio are convinced that not only is the slave power trying to extend slavery westward, but they might try to bring the institution north. Politicians in the new Republican Party, which you and your neighbors now support, are claiming that the next step for the slave power is exactly this. If the Supreme Court says that slaves have no constitutional rights, and that territories cannot regulate the traffic of slaves as property, what would stop slaveholders from bringing their slaves north and suing to keep their, quote, property there? You start to notice that even local newspapers that hadn't taken much of a stance on slavery in the past are all now starting to acknowledge the existence of this nefarious slave power, a conspiracy of slaveholders who will stop at nothing until the entire country is effectively run like a slave state. Now let's take a step back from this thought exercise to ask, is this true? Was there actually a plot among slaveholders to take over the American government and make slavery the law of the land? In my opinion, if you lived at the time and had anti-slavery beliefs, you wouldn't have to be some kind of a crank to believe it. I think certain aspects of the slave power conspiracy were exaggerated, as I'll explain. But the spirit of this conspiracy theory is ultimately true, and not some kind of mass paranoia. Let's examine where the theory came from and how it spread. The warnings against a slave power date back to at least the 1830s, when it was a common phrase among the small number of abolitionists in American society. The full and complete abolition of slavery from everywhere in the country, including the South, was not a mainstream position in the U.S. Sure, plenty of people in the North hated slavery, and they wanted to prevent its expansion into the territories, but they felt that the Constitution gave the federal government no power to limit slavery at the state level. In the North, abolitionists were often seen as radicals who threatened the Union with their fiery rhetoric. In the South, they could be seen as dangerous outsiders who threatened the foundations of society itself. Still, the abolitionists were morally right. But for several reasons, they had trouble gaining mass support in the United States. For one, the voting population in the 1830s was, as a rule, white men. And until the 1820s, white men with property in most states. In order to convince white voters in the North to join their cause, abolitionists began to warn of a vast slave power that sought not just to control the slaves in the South, but to dominate the government of the entire country, and possibly even extend the institution to whites. There was no actual danger that whites would be subject to chattel slavery, although these warnings were based on real arguments that some pro-slavery advocates were making at the time, as we'll learn later. But abolitionists could and did reasonably argue that slavery was not in the interests of laborers in the North, because having to compete with a captive labor force that's compelled to work for free might depress wages elsewhere. Many abolitionists stressed the relationship between wealthy textile mill owners in New England with the slave power in the South. Their goal was to spur working-class voters into action against slavery by recognizing the union between industrialists in the North with slave owners in the South. The abolitionist Wendell Phillips phrased this alliance of capital as, quote, "the lords of the lash and the lords of the loom." As hostile to racial equality as the country was at this time, many Americans in the 1830s and 1840s expressed hatred of hierarchies and centralized power of any kind, and they were prone to think in conspiratorial terms. Jacksonian Democrats won over hundreds of thousands of voters with polemics against national banks and profit speculation because of this. And most people were proud that the United States was one of the few countries with no official aristocracy or king. In the right hands, a strategy that portrayed wealthy slave owners as a dangerous aristocratic elite bent on controlling the government might be pretty effective. Unfortunately, most prominent abolitionists in the 1830s had one other belief that made them unpopular. They thought the Constitution was a pro-slavery document, and therefore an evil to be fought. William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips were two prominent abolitionists that held the view that the Constitution, as it was written, protected the institution of slavery. Once again, they were probably right. But this prevented them from making much headway with the voting public, since the Constitution at this time was almost worshipped like a holy book. It was a couple generations since the document had been drafted, and many Americans saw the United States as a living experiment with a republican form of government, one that needed to be constantly guarded and protected from monarchs on the outside and disunion from the inside. To insult the document that founded the country sounded like disunion, and therefore something near sacrilege. Those opposed to slavery in the United States would have to find another way to make their ideas popular. One anti-slavery activist in the 1840s thought he had an answer. His name was Salmon P. Chase, a lawyer in Ohio who first came to prominence defending people who were arrested for violating the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, either because they assisted the escape of slaves northward, or they were escaped slaves themselves. Like the early abolitionists, Chase detested slavery. But unlike them, he thought the framers of the Constitution did too. Chase was something of an expert in the early laws regarding slavery, and he came to the conclusion that, although the founders allowed slavery to exist in the South, they believed that the default state of the federal government was one of freedom, meaning that slavery had no legal right to extend into the Western territories or in the District of Columbia. Chase believed that the Constitution, because it never mentioned slavery by name, was a cautiously written document that allowed the South to preserve slavery for the time being, but with the understanding that it would eventually die out. The slave power played a major role in Salmon Chase's political views, because he believed that a conspiracy of wealthy slave owners were now trying to betray the original intentions of the founders, to take control of the federal government, and to make slavery the law of the land. It is true that pro-slavery forces in the U.S. by the 1850s were much more aggressive in their defense of slavery than the writers of the Constitution ever were. But most historians agree that Chase was probably wrong to assume that the authors of the Constitution were anti-slavery. It was how many of them made their wealth, after all. But Salmon Chase's worldview had a profound impact on the anti-slavery movement. It blended the mistrust of elites from the slave power theory with a deep patriotism and defense of the Constitution. Both of these ways of thinking were very popular in the North in the mid-19th century. Chase drew much of his inspiration from the slave power from another politician from Ohio, Senator Thomas Morris. Morris started out as a Democrat who railed against the so-called money power of the central banks and powerful corporations. But in a speech to the Senate in 1839, he also spoke out against Senator Henry Clay for denouncing abolitionists, and he uttered the first ever condemnation of the slave power by name in the Senate. Here's Morris in 1839. "Permit me to tell the country now what this power behind the throne, greater than the throne itself, is. It is the power of slavery. It is a power, according to the calculation of the senator from Kentucky, which owns $1,200,000,000 in human beings as property. And if money is power, this power is not to be conceived or calculated, a power which claims human property more than double the amount which the whole money of the world could purchase." Thomas Morris, like Salmon Chase, would go on to join the Liberty Party, a new party made up of abolitionists and anti-slavery advocates who, unlike their predecessors, believed that the Constitution was an anti-slavery document. Chase became one of the party's chief propagandists. One of the first problems that he set out to fix was the moralizing tone of the party's messaging. Most abolitionist speakers up to this point were Protestant ministers of some kind, not office holders. Although Chase himself was deeply religious, he knew that what the anti-slavery movement needed was a political argument, not just a moral one. He found that argument in the slave power conspiracy. Throughout the 1840s, the language of a cabal of slaveholders capturing the federal government and twisting the original intent of the Constitution to serve the needs of their brutal system were all over Liberty Party speeches, platforms, and written statements. The party platform in 1846 stated that the slave power had turned the Constitution from, quote, "the safeguard of liberty into a bulwark of slavery." It was an intentional choice to stress the language of conspiracy and an evil slave power, and it seemed to be working. As Joshua Leavitt, a Liberty Party leader, wrote to Salmon Chase in 1848, quote, "I am struck with the facility which this word has come into use in the documents of both Democrats and Whigs. The slave power is now indissolubly incorporated in the political nomenclature of the country. We must make the most of that word. Let it appear that it is the slave power which we wish to restrict and curtail, that it is the slave power whose demands we resist, and whose growth we will put down." Salmon Chase would be elected that year as the senator from Ohio of the Free Soil Party, an alliance between the Liberty Party and anti-slavery members of the Democrats. The slave power conspiracy theory was an effective piece of propaganda for the growing numbers of voters in the North who opposed slavery. But just how much of it was true? In the next part of the episode, we'll examine a few common claims of those who railed against the slave power and how close they were to reality. The most important claim of the slave power conspiracy is that a group of powerful slave owners and their allies had either already captured the federal government or were attempting to do so. The language around this claim differed between various abolitionists. Liberty Party candidate James Birney claimed that the slave power effectively took over the government after the Missouri Compromise in 1820, while others talked about the slave power's takeover as a more gradual process. But it was rarely seen as the work of a small, tightly organized cabal. Salmon Chase estimated that the slave power involved about 350,000 people, roughly 1% of the country's population, united in a common cause of turning the power of the national government towards the protection of slavery. For me, this aspect of the slave power conspiracy seems to be obviously true. The only mistake that I think the purveyors of the theory made is that none of it was done in secret. Powerful slaveholders and their allies really did successfully entrench themselves into the federal government, and they really did direct state power towards the extension of slavery. Where this departs from the slave power conspiracy is that the slave owners and their allies were not a highly secret organization that all got together to plan a takeover. They were a class of people who shared a strong material interest in the dollar value of the human beings that they owned. Slavery was big business, and slave owners essentially had the most powerful lobby in United States history to defend it. Let's look at the numbers. From the country's founding until the election of 1860, 11 of 15 presidents were either slaveholders themselves or Northerners like Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan, who were widely understood to be allies of slavery. 3 out of 5 Supreme Court justices were Southerners who came from slave-owning families, and a majority of congressional committee chairs were Southerners, despite the South having a smaller voting population than the North. The very existence of the Senate benefited Southern slaveholders, since their appointment to Congress was not based on voting population, and the North had long been outstripping the South in population by 1850. The Three-Fifths Compromise also meant that slaveholders were awarded representation of three-fifths of their slave population, people who could not vote and obviously had opposing interests to the people who held them in captivity. All of this was true, and this was at the heart of the slave power conspiracy. Salmon Chase himself claimed that the Three-Fifths Compromise, quote, has virtually established in the country an aristocracy of slaveholders. All of this does seem to contradict Salmon Chase's claim that the Constitution was written as an anti-slavery document. But the end result was that politicians who had an interest in protecting the institution of slavery were vastly overrepresented in the highest levels of the federal government. And this wasn't just true for the Oval Office or Congress. In the mid-19th century, the diplomatic corps of the United States was largely the realm of slaveholders. When we focus on domestic policy, it's easy to overlook just how much of U.S. foreign policy in this period was driven by the interests of slavery. But this did not go unnoticed by abolitionists and anti-slavery politicians at the time. Opponents of slavery criticized the Polk administration for the annexation of Texas and for the Mexican-American War. They believed that both decisions would open the West to the possibility of slavery, and they were right. But like the adherents of the slave power conspiracy claimed, there really were conscious efforts among slaveholders to protect their interests through the foreign policy of the federal government. We have an image of Southern planters in the 19th century as isolated feudal barons, in part because they were a type of aristocracy in many ways. But these were people who exported a cash crop on the world market. The cotton their slaves grew for them went to the textile mills of Massachusetts or Lancashire in England. A Southern planter was a particularly brutal type of businessman, and his business depended on international trade. They all knew this, and they knew that the North, with its growing manufacturing base and its rising population of immigrant laborers, could soon overtake them economically and doom the slave society. Because of this, slaveholders had a keen interest in international politics, and they were always looking for ways that they could expand slavery into other parts of the Western Hemisphere and extend the life of their oppressive economic system. Allies of slavery were always well represented in the executive offices that touched foreign policy. By 1850, a majority of secretaries of state had been Southerners. The historian W.E.B. Du Bois claimed that at least 80 out of 134 of the nation's ambassadors and foreign ministers just before the Civil War were Southerners. Former president-turned-anti-slavery agitator John Quincy Adams also noticed the domination of slaveholders in the nation's foreign affairs, claiming in a speech in 1848 that, quote, "The executive departments, the army, the navy, the supreme judicial court and diplomatic missions abroad all present an immense majority of power in the hands of a very small minority." Because of the politics surrounding the Civil War, slavery today is often remembered as an issue of states' rights. But Southern politicians made a conscious effort to use the diplomatic and military power of the federal government of the United States in order to protect and extend the institution of slavery every chance they got. After Britain abolished slavery in the 1830s, Southern planters took a keen interest in guiding the U.S. military into a position to contend with this global power that was now turning its cannons to the international slave trade. Prominent Southerners, like Navy Secretary Abel Upshur, pushed to expand the size of the American fleet, in part to protect the commercial interests of slaveholders in the Western Hemisphere. These agents of the slave power went on the offensive, too. In 1854, a group of high-level American ambassadors to European powers, Pierre Soulé for Spain, James Mason for France, and James Buchanan for Britain, met in Ostend, Belgium, to secretly plot the conquest of Cuba from Spain. They planned to demand that Spain sell the island to the United States, or the country would take it by force, adding another slave state to the Senate, and more power for the slaveholding interests in Washington. Fortunately for us, James Buchanan wrote all of their plans down, and the document was leaked to the press, causing a major scandal. The Ostend conspiracy was abandoned. James Buchanan would go on to become president 2 years later and accidentally help start the Civil War. Pro-slavery advocates engaged in even more blatant attempts to expand the institution to Latin America in the 1850s through the practice of filibustering. Though we know the term filibustering today as making long speeches in the Senate, in the period just before the Civil War, it referred to the practice of groups of armed Americans, usually Southerners, venturing into Mexico or Central America to find a country in civil unrest and exploiting the local conflict to claim power in the region. The most famous filibuster of the era was a Tennessean named William Walker. In 1855, he and a band of other Americans took part in a civil war in the Central American country of Nicaragua. After he helped defeat one of the sides in the conflict, Walker declared himself the commander-in-chief of Nicaragua, and streams of American adventurers poured into the country. Southern planters quickly saw this as an opportunity for expanding slavery, since the climate of Central America was conducive to plantation agriculture. Pierre Soulé of the famous Ostend Manifesto even had a clause included in the Democratic Party platform in 1856 that endorsed Walker's actions in Central America. Eventually, Walker would overplay his hand, and he would be deposed from power and shot by a firing squad in Honduras. But he enjoyed the support of thousands throughout the South, including slaveholding senators and congressmen. A key component of the slave power conspiracy was that the slave power was never satisfied with keeping its institutions at the state level. It was always looking to expand, and that meant beyond the borders of the United States, too. This part of the conspiracy theory was all too true. Now we turn to perhaps the flimsiest part of the slave power theory, the idea that slaveholders intended to extend slavery to the North to dominate the political life of white Northerners and potentially even enslave them. Most historians today agree that there was probably no real threat of chattel slavery being extended into the free states, and there was certainly no threat of white Northerners experiencing slavery themselves. But if you look at what many prominent slaveholders of the time were saying in their own words, these fears were not completely paranoia. One of the developments in U.S. politics in the 1830s that sparked the idea of a slave power was an increasingly aggressive defense of slavery from Southern politicians. At the time the Constitution was written, it was pretty common for upper-class slave owners to talk about slavery as if they were almost embarrassed by it. The thinking went something like this. Well, sure, this grotesque system of forced labor dehumanizes millions of people and it funds my lavish lifestyle, but one day it'll probably sort itself out. Not now, though. But just a couple decades later, the slave revolts like that of Denmark Vesey in Charleston, or Nat Turner's in Virginia, frightened slave owners to their bones. The constant fear of being overpowered by the slaves who outnumbered them, coupled with the competition that they faced from an increasingly industrialized North, compelled many slave drivers in the South to not just make excuses for slavery, but argue for it as something beneficial to the country. Perhaps the most famous advocate for slavery as a positive good was the South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun. As Calhoun said in a Senate speech in 1837, "The relation now existing in the slaveholding states between the two races is, instead of an evil, a good, a positive good." This argument for slavery as a positive good had been adopted by thousands of prominent slave owners by the end of the decade, and arguments over slavery in Congress and the country at large became more rancorous. When the abolitionists of the time said that the slave owners' thirst for power also hurt the civil liberties of whites in the North, they weren't speaking in the abstract. They were probably thinking of the violent pro-slavery mobs that attacked abolitionists, and sometimes murdered them whenever they tried to speak. Or they were probably thinking of the other violent mobs who destroyed their printing presses and threw them into rivers just for printing abolitionist newspapers. Or they were thinking of the gag rule in Congress that blocked anti-slavery petitions from ever coming to the floor for debate and discussion. In fact, it was this gag rule that compelled Senator Thomas Morris of Ohio to speak out against his slave-owning colleagues and to utter the words "slave power" for the first time in the Senate. Abolitionists argued that the slave power was a corrosive force that infringed on the civil liberties of all Americans, because they saw this happen, and they felt it happen whenever they tried to speak out. But because of the deep racism of the country, they could not move large numbers of white voters in the North to take action on behalf of the slaves themselves. However, they were beginning to convince them that no matter their feelings toward slavery's true victims, the slave power would come for them too. But did the slave power intend to bring slavery North? Many slave owners themselves, including prominent ones like Jefferson Davis, thought that the idea of extending it northward was ridiculous. But that didn't stop many of the most extreme supporters of the institution arguing for it, and publicly. One such extremist was South Carolina Senator James Henry Hammond. Hammond was a pro-slavery firebrand from perhaps the most pro-slavery state in the Union. In 1858, he gave a speech to the Senate that not just made excuses for slavery, or even defended it as a positive good, but insisted that it was superior to the free labor system in the North. He argued that all societies, free or slave, rest on a, quote, mudsill, or a foundation of laboring classes. To quote Hammond, "Fortunately for the South, she found a race adapted to that purpose to her hand. We use them for our purpose, and call them slaves. We are old-fashioned at the South yet. Slave is a word discarded now by ears polite. I will not characterize that class at the North by that term, but you have it. It is there. It is everywhere. It is eternal." Hammond argued that the industrial working class of the North, though they were technically paid, lived no better than slaves in the South, and probably they were worse off. It was a common rhetorical trick at this time among slaveholders to needle Yankees over the hypocrisy of their anti-slavery sentiments while poorly paid laborers toiled away in the so-called free states. The argument rested on Hammond's false notion that slaves in the South were actually well taken care of, which they were not, and actually enjoyed their enslavement, which they did not. But Hammond's mudsill theory adds another twist. If all societies, everywhere, are bound to have a foundational class of manual laborers, And if you believe that the South has found the ideal solution to this law of history, doesn't it follow that the North should implement slavery too? Hammond didn't say this explicitly, although some slaveholders did. Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia once claimed that he hoped to, quote, call the roll of his slaves on Bunker Hill, a phrase that made for good propaganda in the anti-slavery press. Yet another Southern firebrand followed James Henry Hammond's argument to its logical conclusion, and then some. The writer George Fitzhugh of Virginia did not hold elected office himself, but he was a popular political writer in the 1850s. He was the author of two books, Sociology for the South and a later publication called Cannibals All. In both of them, he argued not just for the protection, but the supremacy of the slave society. Like Hammond's mudsill theory, Fitzhugh strongly believed that every society on Earth, from the dawn of human memory, has to have a servile class of manual laborers. He drew inspiration from biblical stories of slavery, ancient Roman and Greek history, and the feudal relationships between nobles and peasants in medieval Europe to argue in favor of this structure. Unlike many other Southern writers at the time, however, he had open disgust for the Republican systems of government. He believed that the South had largely figured out how to create a functioning, harmonious caste system, but that the capitalist North was leaving its social mudsill of laborers to suffer in poverty. Fitzhugh's solution for the North was a reintroduction of some form of bonded labor. He didn't believe that chattel slavery was suitable for whites, but on more than one occasion, he claimed that some form of indentured servitude or serfdom would do them good. As Fitzhugh argued in one 1860 essay, quote, "We know that you would not have a Yankee as a gracious gift, but this is all prejudice. Catch them young, train, domesticate, and civilize them, and they would make as faithful and valuable servants as those indented servants which our colonial ancestors brought over in such large numbers from England. It is a libel on white men to say that they are unfit for slavery." George Fitzhugh was an extremist, and his views on extending slavery to the North, and especially to white people, were not in the mainstream of Southern opinion at the time. But he wasn't some obscure figure either. He was from an established Virginia family. He was a popular author in the 1850s, he frequently debated abolitionists, and his articles regularly appeared in DeBow's Review, the most popular magazine in the South at the time. You could argue that Fitzhugh was just a troll. In fact, he shares a lot of the same goading, "I'm just kidding, or am I," tone that you might find with teenage reactionaries on the internet today. But the anti-slavery voters who believed in the slave power made it clear that they were not going to give these people the benefit of the doubt. If people like George Fitzhugh, or James Hammond, or Robert Toombs said these things, then they took them at their word. They couldn't afford not to. As the abolitionist William Goodell said, quote, "The South is thoroughly in earnest. She is no land of shams. There is reality, terrible reality there." The idea of the slave power as a deliberate secret plot among slaveholders, and one that would eventually bring slavery north, is overwrought, but it was based in a dangerous political development that was very real. Slaveholders actually did disagree on many political issues, from tariffs to annexation of new territories. But the fact is, they had a material interest in preserving human slavery, and they did work together to advance those interests in the federal government. By definition, large slaveholders in the United States were rich and powerful people. They used the benefits the Constitution gave them to win representation well above their numbers. And once the fiercest defenders of slavery captured the executive branch, they filled the ranks of the country's diplomatic service with the express purpose of protecting slavery and even extending its reach. There were many unfortunate reasons why abolitionists and their allies relied on the slave power argument. Voters in national elections were white, often racist, and were not easily won over by appeals to the humanity of black people facing oppression. But the slave power argument did catch on, and galvanized Northern voters against slavery. And I believe it did that for one reason in particular. It gave people a class enemy. Voters across the country had already been mobilized against the overreach of chartered corporations, of central banks, and against creditors and other moneyed interests. But what is a slave driver, if not the worst moneyed interest of them all? Politicians like Salmon Chase were able to combine the moral argument against the evils of slavery with a political program built around striking back against the slave power. That, along with the sudden collapse of the Whigs, allowed the anti-slavery movement to grow into a major political party by 1856. At this time, arguments against the slave power conspiracy were fully in the mainstream of political opinion in the North, along with warnings that there could be no further compromise with the slave power, and giving in would destroy the country forever and wreck the Union. As Salmon Chase wrote in the Appeal of the Independent Democrats in 1854, quote, "The Union was formed to establish justice and secure the blessings of liberty. When it fails to accomplish these ends, it will be worthless, and when it becomes worthless, it cannot long endure." When the slave power, as the Republicans of the time understood it, could no longer control the federal government, and when they felt that they finally had an enemy in the executive branch within Abraham Lincoln, they quickly abandoned their goal of directing the United States to protect their slave empire. Instead, they broke the Union and formed a new government for their slave power. In the next bonus episode, we'll talk about some of the soldiers who helped deal the fatal blow to that slave power in the South. Black soldiers of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this month's topic. Sources for this episode, again, include James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, This Vast Southern Empire by Matt Karp, and especially the book Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men by the historian Eric Foner. I'll link all other sources in the description. Thanks again.